Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for Thursday, November 7th's reading of the Christian Science Monitor Daily. My name is Sherry McCundan. Today I'll be reading premium stories from Wednesday, November 6th, and following up with miscellaneous articles. In this issue, what Trump's historic victory says about America. What's behind the Latino shift toward Trump and the GOP? Republicans retake Senate as voters reject party in power. Ukraine's jittery new reality. Work with Trump and hope for the best. Today's intro by Amelia Newcomb, Managing Editor. A sweeping moment. Today we start digging into the meaning of a historic election, one that in many ways marks the culmination of Donald Trump's decisive realignment of the Republican Party and his regnant place in American politics. Given the sweeping results, we've devoted this issue of the Daily entirely to election stories, from the influence of Latino men in the results to what our reporter found at an election watch party with people who are watching extremely closely, Ukrainians. What Trump's historic victory says about America. Former President Donald Trump's win reflected many voters' frustration with issues from border security to the cost of living to America's role in the world, and is part of a larger anti-incumbent backlash seen in other Western democracies. By Linda Feldman, staff writer, Washington. The American people have spoken, and the message in Tuesday's historic victory by once and now future President Donald Trump came through loud and clear. A majority of voters wanted change, sort of. That sounds contradictory, but here's the logic. Americans are tired of paying higher prices and a feeling that the nation projects weakness, especially on the immigration issue. Those were the top issues for Trump supporters in the exit polls. Voters' way of affecting change was to boot the current administration, as represented by Vice President Kamala Harris, and bring back a familiar face, former President Trump. In America's two-party system, those were the only viable choices on the ballot. The votes of the hold your nose and vote for Trump cohort counted just as much as those of the enthusiastic MAGA hat-wearing supporters. It is doubtless the most stunning political comeback in American history, given Mr. Trump's two first-term impeachments, criminal convictions, and unorthodox strongman style that seems to break all the rules of normal political discourse. Mr. Trump's survival of two recent assassination attempts, to some supporters a sign that God was involved, only enhanced his mystique. Beyond a repudiation of the status quo, it's clear plenty of Trump voters like what they see. That includes both his brash style and policies aimed at addressing America's deep frustration with everything from border security to the cost of living to the United States' role in the world. 2016 was not an aberration, says Chris Borick, director of the Muhlenberg College Institute of Public Opinion in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Trump's victory in 2016, along with what happened last night, makes a case that much of what he sells from a political perspective is what Americans want. But this election also reflects a larger anti-incumbent backlash seen in other Western democracies, from the United Kingdom and likely soon Canada, to New Zealand, Australia, and the deeply unpopular leaders of France and Germany. Before the U.S. election, political observer Matthew Iglesias wondered out loud why all post-COVID electorates are grumpy and miserable. Some analysts caution against reading too much into Mr. Trump's victory, noting that Democrats faced strong structural headwinds. Polls show that the percentage of Americans saying they were satisfied with the direction of the country was only in the mid-20s, a clear danger zone for an incumbent party. It is difficult to interpret this result as a mandate, says presidential historian George Edwards III, a professor emeritus at Texas A&M University. The country remains divided. Still, Democrats face their share of blame for the loss, which saw a Republican presidential nominee win the popular vote for the first time in 20 years. At press time, Mr. Trump had 51% of the popular vote to Vice President Harris's 47.5%, though that margin could shrink as California counts its votes. Democrats need to do some real soul searching. They were pretty massively repudiated in the election, says veteran political analyst Charlie Cook in an email. At the time of writing, Mr. Trump had won 292 electoral votes, 22 more than needed to win. He appeared to set to win even more in the states still counting ballots, including Arizona and Nevada, which would make for a sweep of all seven battleground states. Late Wednesday afternoon, Ms. Harris delivered a concession speech on the campus of her alma mater, Howard University. "The light of America's promise will always burn bright," she said, after a congratulatory phone call to Mr. Trump. Earlier in the day, the Trump campaign released a statement saying, "President Trump acknowledged Vice President Harris on her strength, professionalism, and tenacity throughout the campaign." Mr. Cook praises Ms. Harris's performance as a candidate, better than many expected, and her campaign was very competent, but notes it wasn't enough, and he blames the Biden administration for overreaching in its agenda after winning the 2020 election only narrowly. The Trump victory was a massive repudiation of the Biden-Harris 4 years in general, and specifically their economic and border policies, Mr. Cook says. During the Biden presidency, inflation averaged 5.2% year over year versus 1.9% under Trump. On the southern border, President Joe Biden saw illegal crossings soar during his first 3 years in office, far higher than in the decade before he took office. "You cannot overstimulate the economy, creating inflation levels that have been pretty dormant for over 30 years and not have a massive backlash," Mr. Cook adds. "You cannot ignore the border for 3 years, only settling down to address it in your last year and not face a massive backlash." This analysis suggests that a different Democratic nominee might not have fared much better this cycle. Still, the what-ifs of the Democratic effort are flying thick and fast. First, up for recriminations, maybe President Biden. What if the octogenarian had stuck to his original suggestion that he be a bridge president, i.e. a one-termer, and announced he wouldn't run for the second term early last year, allowing for proper primary competition among the next generation of Democratic leaders? Instead, his initial decision to run for a second term, only to be pushed out of the race by fellow Democrats less than 4 months before the election day, left the party scrambling. Ms. Harris, the nominee by default, had little time to introduce herself to voters and establish an identity apart from the Biden brand. Ms. Harris's decision to make Minnesota Governor Tim Walz her running mate rather than popular Governor Josh Shapiro of Pennsylvania, the nation's biggest battleground state, also raises questions. It appears a Harris-Shapiro ticket likely also would not have prevailed, but we'll never know what his rhetorical skills and centrist bridge-building persona could have brought to the effort to win over swing voters. To die-hard Trump opponents, the test now is to practice what they preached, accept the election result, and prepare to counter what some see as the potentially existential threat Mr. Trump poses to American democracy. Exit polls show that defending democracy was the number one issue for Harris's voters. "Citizens across this country, our courts, members of the press, and those serving in our federal, state, and local governments must now be the guardrails of democracy," former Wyoming Representative Liz Cheney, an anti-Trump Republican and a former party leader, said in a statement Wednesday. The Republican takeover of the Senate, with 3 seats gained so far, suggests that this chamber may not be the check on Mr. Trump some opponents are hoping for. The GOP-controlled Senate will also ease confirmations of Trump cabinet and judicial nominees. At press time, control of the House remained up for grabs. But the real story of the 2024 election is with the voters themselves and why they voted the way they did. Mr. Trump made gains with nearly every demographic group, but the most noteworthy shift was among Hispanic voters, particularly men. In 2020, Mr. Biden won Hispanic men by 23 percentage points. This year, Mr. Trump won that demographic by 10 points. Overall, 40% of Hispanic voters cited the economy as their most important issue, 9 points higher than the population as a whole. In Los Angeles, Isabel Velez, who owns a real estate business with her husband, cast a ballot for Mr. Trump, while keeping her support from him quiet among her friends who don't all agree. She points to interest rates, violence, and abortion as her top reasons. First-time voter Devon Che also voted for Mr. Trump. The 21-year-old artist was unhappy that the U.S., under President Biden, seemed to be funding war in Ukraine and Gaza. He also recalls easier economic times when Mr. Trump was in office. It was very easy just to live life and buy day-to-day things and not worry about saving as much. At the polls in Hobart, Wisconsin, on Tuesday morning, Dan Shenkendore said he was still pondering his options when he left his home in nearby Oneida to go vote. He supported Mr. Trump in 2016, but switched to vote for Mr. Biden in 2020. It was a difficult time with the pandemic and all the confusion, says Mr. Shenkendore, a police officer and member of the Oneida Nation of 2020. It seemed like there was a need for strong leadership, but Mr. Biden disappointed him. Mr. Shenkendore's own economic situation became more difficult. I pay more in taxes, he said. My money is worth less. Mr. Shenkendore likes Mr. Trump's idea of ending taxes on overtime pay, even though he calls it unrealistic. He also has positive words for Ms. Harris, citing her message of hope, and he paid close attention to the TV ads during the Packers-Lions NFL game Sunday. In the end, he says, he voted for Mr. Trump. Staff writer Allie Martin contributed to this report from Los Angeles, and contributor Richard Mertens from Hobart, Wisconsin. What's behind the Latino shift toward Trump and the GOP? Donald Trump's victory was aided by a significant rise in Latino support, according to exit polls. Some voters shifted loyalties due to concerns over the economy and inflation. By Jackie Valley and Sarah Matusik, staff writers, Las Vegas and Phoenix. Former President Donald Trump's resounding victory appears buoyed by a key constituency, Latino voters, whose economic concerns may have outweighed his harsh rhetoric surrounding immigration. As of Wednesday afternoon, an NBC News exit poll suggests 46% of Latino voters went Republican in this election, and that share was even greater, 55%, among Latino men. Those percentages significantly exceed Mr. Trump's performance in the 2020 election, when the same exit poll estimated Republican support from 32% of Latino voters and 36% of Latino men. Experts caution against reading too much into exit polls, which may be skewed, given the large share of citizens voting early or by mail ballot. On top of that, Latinos are not a monolithic voting bloc, says John Tooman, Executive Associate Dean in Liberal Arts and Political Science Professor at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Their views can differ based on everything from ancestry and country of origin to religion and housing situations. And even with gains among Latino voters, Republican victories are largely the result of overwhelming support among white voters. 57% of white voters who make up the bulk of the electorate cast ballots in favoring the GOP, according to the NBC News exit poll. Still, the big question now is what motivated the apparent surge of Republican support from Latino voters, who by some estimates could make up nearly 15% of the U.S. electorate this year. In certain battleground states, that percentage is even higher. Latinos were expected to represent a quarter of Arizona voters. In Nevada, they make up about one in every five voters. For many different demographic groups, including Latinos, inflation was just really a big driving factor, says Dr. Tooman, who has researched Latino voters. It was very hard for Biden and then Harris, who took over as candidate very late in the campaign, to push back against that narrative. 85% of Latino voters cited the economy as very important in the presidential election, topping all other issues, according to a Pew Research Center survey released in September. Outside a Phoenix Vote Center Tuesday, an I Voted sticker is affixed to the brim of Sebastian Mario's baseball cap. The first-time voter and Mexican-born American chose Mr. Trump on the economy. Now that I'm an adult and I've got to pay my own bills, I feel like it's really hard on people's pockets, says the 20-something plumber. I actually didn't like Trump, he clarified. However, I like his plan better. Mr. Mario thought to himself as he voted, don't make me regret this. Jesus Marquez, a conservative strategist with the American Christian Caucus, agrees that economic concerns propelled more Latino voters toward Mr. Trump and Republicans, a trend afoot for several election cycles now. But he contends it's more than that. Mr. Marquez says that many Latino voters want stronger border security and greater parental rights, among other issues. Mr. Trump, he says, is the candidate who delivered that message in an unwavering fashion. On the Democratic side, Ms. Harris devoted a lot of time and messaging to reproductive rights, which Mr. Marquez said didn't necessarily have the same tug as other policy concerns among Latino voters. There's a lot of women who support abortion up until a certain stage, but they care more for other things, he says. They care more for providing for the family, for food, for the economy, and for security. Democrats, however, hoped Mr. Trump's incendiary language about illegal immigration and plans for mass deportations would pull voters to their side. Vice President Kamala Harris routinely condemned such rhetoric, including that immigrants are poisoning the blood of our country. And in the waning days of the campaign, a comedian at Mr. Trump's Madison Square Garden rally called Puerto Rico a floating island of garbage. For some, that language did make a difference. Joshua Berrios, a Puerto Rican from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, was an undecided voter for much of the election, until he saw a clip of comedian Tony Hinchcliffe's performance at Mr. Trump's rally. He cast his vote for Ms. Harris. The rhetoric wasn't enough to move the needle for other voters, though. In Aurora, Colorado, Denise Schifino was also drawn to Mr. Trump on the economy. The Mexican-born Republican lost her job in the mortgage industry in 2022 as interest rates began to climb. But she's also seen how her city has grappled with an influx of new South American immigrants, including suspects of crimes who officials have linked to a Venezuelan gang. "I don't believe in just coming and then trying to get everything for free," she said in a line at a Trump rally last month. Hardworking Americans, meanwhile, don't get any of that help. In Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, longtime Democrat Evelyn Augusto voted for Joe Biden in 2020. But during the pandemic, vaccine mandates drove her away from the party, and she changed her affiliation to Republican. On Tuesday, she voted for Mr. Trump. Ms. Augusto, born in Puerto Rico, found the mockery of her native island at the recent Trump rally in Madison Square Garden distasteful, but it didn't lead her to reconsider her vote. "I wouldn't vote for the other party just because the comedian messed up," Ms. Augusto said. "I'm sticking with my beliefs." Staff writers Caitlin Babcock and Sophie Hills contributed reporting from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Republicans retake Senate as voters reject party in power. Voters have put the U.S. Senate back under Republican control. One upshot, they will hold the keys to approving nominees for executive branch posts, federal judgeships, and the Supreme Court. By Francine Kiefer, staff writer. Former President Donald Trump's sweeping electoral victory extended to down-ballot Republicans, who wrestled control of the U.S. Senate away from Democrats. The GOP flipped two Senate seats in Ohio and West Virginia, and as of Wednesday afternoon, seemed likely to grow their majority with wins in the Rust Belt and Western states, where votes were still being counted. Control of the U.S. House remained too close to call, but it's entirely possible Mr. Trump will come back to Washington having won a trifecta, with both chambers of Congress in Republican hands. In a year when Democrats had more seats to defend than Republicans, they had hoped to save their majority by perhaps flipping a few seats of their own in Florida and Texas. But it was not to be, as Republican Senators Rick Scott of Florida and Ted Cruz of Texas held their ground, and voters punishing Democrats over the economy and immigration. In Ohio, Republican Bernie Moreno ousted incumbent Democrat Sherrod Brown, with criticism of Democrats on border security helping the Colombian-born businessman to victory. Popular West Virginia Governor Jim Justice handily won the Senate seat being vacated by retiring Senator Joe Manchin, the independent who caucused with Democrats. Mr. Justice was so confident of victory, he barely even campaigned against his opponent, Glenn Elliott, the Democrat former mayor of Wheeling. "In the primary, I didn't put a sign out," he said during a press conference. "Think about this for a second. I didn't put one single sign up, and I won by 35-plus points. The people of the state know me. They know me, and they know me really well. I've done almost zero campaigning." The Senate switch will put Republicans in charge of the agenda in that chamber. They will hold the keys to executive branch nominations and federal judgeships, as well as any vacancies that might arise in the Supreme Court. Trump will be able to get any confirmations that he likes, says Jeffrey Jenkins, a public policy professor at the University of Southern California. And right off the bat, lawmakers will be staring at an expiring federal debt ceiling and tax cuts from the first Trump administration that will end at the conclusion of 2025. The stakes are going to be really high, right out of the box. They're going to have to deal with the government spending, raising the debt limit, says Kevin Kosar, an expert on Congress at the American Enterprise Institute. But first, Republicans will need to pick their new majority leader in a secret ballot election set for next week. In the running are South Dakota Senator John Thune, the number two Senate Republican, Texas Senator John Cornyn, who termed out of GOP leadership, and Senator Rick Scott of Florida. Both Senators Thune and Cornyn are more traditional conservatives, while Senator Scott has deep ties to the party's right wing, says Sarah Binder, political science professor at the George Washington University, who has long studied Congress. Staunch Trump loyalist Senator Mike Lee of Utah appears to be playing kingmaker. He has announced that each of the candidates has agreed to participate at a forum that he will moderate on November 12th. At the same time, he has issued a letter to colleagues calling for Senate reforms, especially allowing for more freedom for senators to offer amendments on legislation and engage in extended debate. Senator Cruz of Texas, an ally of Senator Lee, this week described outgoing Senator Minority Leader Mitch McConnell as a one-man dictator. Senator McConnell from Kentucky is the longest-serving Republican Senate leader in history and is stepping down from leadership at the end of this year. Senator McConnell, speaking to reporters on Wednesday morning, said he believed the GOP's victory would help preserve the filibuster. One of the most gratifying results of the Senate becoming Republican, the filibuster will stand. There won't be any new states admitted that will benefit the other side, and we'll quit beating up the Supreme Court every time they make a decision we don't like, he said. For many years, the Senate has been sliding toward more control by party leaders. There's been a lot of complaints among senators about feeling like they're eunuchs at the court, says Mr. Kosar. But senators also have themselves to blame, says Dr. Binder, in part because they want protection from amendment votes that could damage them politically. They've not really fought back, she says. Mr. Trump is expected to push his agenda of tax cuts and a restrictive approach to immigration. On trade, Congress long ago ceded power to the president to impose sanctions and raise tariffs. But a Republican Senate will not necessarily walk in lockstep with Mr. Trump. In the Middle East, Ukraine, and Taiwan, different levels of peril will test the Republicans' comfort with interjecting themselves, says Mr. Kosar. And will anyone want to stick their neck out on immigration after they saw Mr. Trump squelch a bipartisan bill on border security? Regardless of the final constellation of party alignment in Washington, Dr. Binder doesn't see a Senate that accomplishes much beyond addressing taxes in the next year or two. That will absorb most of the energies of a Republican Senate. Editor's note, this story was originally published at 12:40 a.m. on Wednesday, November 6th, and has been updated to reflect ongoing developments. Ukraine's jittery new reality. Work with Trump and hope for the best. Many Ukrainians who have followed the U.S. presidential contest almost as if it were their own nervously expressed the sense that their country's future hung in the balance of an election in which they had no say. The Howard LaFranchi, staff writer, Kyiv, Ukraine. Ivan Mashenko kneels down to brush two fingers across the framed portrait of his son, Oleski, who died in battle last year defending Ukraine against Russia's invasion force. Of course, we all want this war to end, but when former President Donald Trump says he can end it in 2 days, it is not real, Mr. Mashenko says, surveying the vast monument to Ukraine's war dead that has sprung up in Kyiv's central Maidan Square. Our only hope now is that he will be back in power, is that he will change his position on supporting Ukraine and change for the best. Like most Ukrainians, Mr. Mashenko has been following the U.S. presidential election almost as if it were his own. Before Wednesday morning, many people across Ukraine's capital expressed nervously a sense that their country's future hung in the balance of an election in which they had no say. Like many of his compatriots, Mr. Mashenko asserts that what happens in Ukraine matters for the world, and so it must matter to a great power like the United States. If the world wants democracy and order, he says, then it must support Ukraine. If Russian President Vladimir Putin wins, he adds, he will not stop here, and he will march to all of Europe. And yet, as he and his sister Olena and nephew Timur visit the makeshift monument's narrow dirt pathways through thousands of tiny Ukrainian flags, he is already resigned to the fact that Mr. Trump will return to the White House, and he says it's time to move forward with this new reality. Ukraine has no choice, he says, but to work with Trump and hope for the best. That sentiment is found elsewhere across the city as Kyiv adjusts to the seismic shift away from President Joe Biden's as long as it takes support and back to President Trump's friendship with Mr. Putin and promises of a rapid end to the war. Mr. Trump's election means we'll have to work hard to communicate with a part of America that we were ignoring before, says Ivana Klimpush-Tsidzatsi, a member of Ukraine's parliament, speaking Wednesday morning on a post-election panel at the Kyiv State School of Administration. Regardless of our position, we have to learn to work with both sides of the U.S. political spectrum, she said. Such realism pervaded the panel taking place in a school conference room, rebaptized Pennsylvania for the occasion. With Trump, we need to learn to differentiate the rhetoric from the action, says Parliament member Yehor Cherniev. We should remember that it was Trump in his first term who first sent arms to Ukraine. It wasn't President Barack Obama, he told his audience. In fact, Trump can be a pragmatic person, even though he sounds like quite an extreme person sometimes. Yet, for all the mourning after realism for some, many Ukrainians remain apprehensive about an election they have been glued to for months, the outcome of which leaves them fearful. I don't want to lose Ukraine, but what we hear from the television analysis is that with Trump, we will lose the war, and then Russia will take Ukraine from us, says Tatiana Hrabchek, who tends her stall of traditional Ukrainian embroidered clothing at the Soviet-era Zinsi Market. Noting that her heart wanted Kamala, while her head told her it would be Mr. Trump, Ms. Harbach said, all we can do now is hope for the best for Ukraine. Yet many vendors along the rows of vegetables, pickled products, and dried fish are quick to point out that while the impact of the U.S. election is likely to be felt intensely in Ukraine, it is also true that what happens in Ukraine matters to the world. We know Trump would help Russia. He says he is friend of Putin, and that would be bad for the world, says Volodymyr Prochenko, who sells a variety of pumpkins at his market stall. Putin would only feel more powerful to attack other countries. Still, the vendors of the Zinsi market are not of one mind. Trump is a true American, but this Kamala is a globalist, says Basarian Gabaleshvili, a Georgian-Ukrainian who, with his wife Elida, sells typical Georgian breads and baked goods. And don't forget, there were no wars under Trump. Trump is a strong man, he adds, and a strong America is good for the world. Yet others cite more worrisome reasons the Trump impact on Russia's war in Ukraine poses grave risks for the world. It's not right that one country can invade another country and succeed in taking it or even part of it, says Ivan, last name withheld, bundled up against the cold of an outside cafe in Kyiv's trendy Zoloti Vorota district. If that can be possible, it means all the security agreements are useless. But we know Trump is for a ceasefire that would leave Russia with our land, adds Ivan, a marketing student who works part-time at McDonald's. Over time, that will not be good for America, and it won't be good for world security. His girlfriend, Sophia, last name withheld, who studies psychology in Kharkiv, says the world needs to remember that the war is not just a conflict over land. It has become a conflict between America and Russia and the world view that each big power represents. She also invokes global food security. Ukraine is a breadbasket of the world, she says, but Russia wants to stop Ukraine from sending its food production to the world. That's another way that Ukraine matters. Others go even bigger picture. What's at stake here is the liberal international order that is beneficial to the United States, says Ivan Homza, a professor of public policy at the Kyiv School of Economics. Noting that Mr. Trump has long railed against the cost of supporting that system of allies and international security and economic institutions, he adds, yes, it costs the U.S., but it also benefits the U.S. well beyond those costs. On another floor of the Kyiv School of Economics, the debate club is taking up the U.S. election. "This election is such an important topic for us," says club deputy head Victoria Hermanchuk. "I have friends with relatives on the front lines. For parents with children and the students here, they all want to know about the scenarios for our future." One lesson Ukraine should learn from its national anxiety over the U.S. election, some say, is that Ukraine should not be so dependent on one country. "We need to find more friends, maybe in Asia," says Vadim Chaplahin from Kharkiv, Ukraine's second largest city, just 20 miles from the Russian border. "I know Putin is not our friend. It's Putin who's killing our children," he says. "So how can I trust a man who's friend with our worst enemy?" Another student chimes in on how he sees a Trump victory. "We all know there are many people who want to end this war, even if it means we need to give some territory to Russia. I think those people might be for Trump," says Sergei Meyer-Baroda, who offers the common argument that if Ukraine gives up territory to Mr. Putin now, the Russians will be back to take more land, even in other countries, and Ukraine will have to fight again. "So for us, this election is a huge, huge thing, but I think for the world, too," he says. "This is like a line drawn. Will the world have more democracy, or will it have more totalitarianism?" Alexander Nusselenko contributed to reporting this story. Voter nostalgia for harmony, balance. Exit polls in the U.S. election hinted a strong desire for a balanced economy and civic peace by the Monitor's editorial board. America's presidential elections are a great survey of public opinion as well as a call to action. Yet, while Donald Trump won both the popular vote and the Electoral College on November 5th, it could be that the exit polls will drive the course of his second term. The theme of those polls? Americans seek a restoration of past norms of balance or harmony, balance in the economy for Trump supporters, and for those who voted for Kamala Harris, harmony in democratic norms. Among the third of voters who identified the economy as their primary concern, 79% chose Mr. Trump, according to Edison Research's exit polls. More specifically, 73% who see inflation as a severe hardship voted for the Republican candidate. They want to bring prices back to pre-pandemic levels and lower their higher cost of living. For those who chose Ms. Harris, a majority are worried far more about the state of democracy than about the economy. They seek the civility and rule of law that were more common before Mr. Trump's first term. The president-elect thanked the American people for his victory and added, "We're going to help heal our country. We're going to help our country heal." That sentiment, if followed, would be a step toward those desires for balance and harmony. That rare, upbeat, and unifying message pointed to another aspect of the exit polls. About 6 in 10 voters say the country's best days are ahead. In 11 key states, inflation dominated the concerns of voters. While the rate of price increases is now low, about 2%, the persistence of high prices from gasoline to housing drove many people to vote for the GOP candidate. Credit card debt, for example, was at a historic high in August, as inflated prices have pushed people to charge more when buying everyday items. With inflation and two wars raging abroad, many voters fondly recalled a pre-pandemic world that was mostly at peace and economically prosperous under Trump, wrote journalist Michael Hirsch in Foreign Policy. Many economists say Mr. Trump's proposed policies, such as tariffs on imported goods, could increase inflation. The exit polls offer the opportunity to temper his agenda and acknowledge the desire of nearly half the voters to restore democratic norms. Merely offering to help the country heal was a first step. Mud boots of empathy in Spain. A flood of goodwill from volunteers after a historic rainstorm shows that a society can bond in affection beyond sharp political divisions, by the Monitor's editorial board. A nation polarized by politics is having a clarifying moment. A week after an intense storm battered its eastern coast, Spain has seen thousands of volunteers come from all directions to help towns devastated by floods. Many traveled miles by bicycle or on foot. "Humanity is still capable of forgetting its differences," says Tony Zamorano, who spent hours on the roof of his submerged car in the town of Savadi. Here, race or economic level don't matter. This solidarity makes you feel great, he told the New York Times. Political differences in Spain bore little relation to the unity felt by ordinary citizens during the disaster. That may be because most Spanish citizens rally around priorities such as dealing with the effects of climate change, according to Miriam Gonzalez and Begoña Lucena, founders of España Mejor, a civil society group. Polarization is a major distraction, they stated in the European Business Review last year. The storm's impact brought a visit by King Felipe VI on Sunday to the city of Paiporta, where floods had swept away thousands of homes and businesses. Some residents pelted him and his entourage with mud and insults out of anger over the government's slow response to the disaster. In an address a few days earlier, the king spoke of the need to build coherent societies based on dialogue and concern for the common good. It is the obligation of institutions, but also of citizens, to fight against everything that separates even one iota from that integral respect that we owe to the person, to any person, to the dignity of any human being, he said. In Paiporta, the king showed what that can look like in practice. His security detail begged him three times to leave the throng. He and Queen Letizia stayed. They listened, hugged, and wept with residents. Anger softened. In a poll published Tuesday in the online newspaper El Español, the townspeople expressed their gratitude for the monarch's visit. They acknowledged the risk they had taken to be there. Back in Madrid, Prime Minister Pedro Sánchez Pérez Castejón said his government should have done more sooner. Spain's unity at this moment is from the bottom up, or as Spanish professional soccer player Ferran Torres wrote on social media, the people are the ones who save the people. Long live Spain. James Madison foresaw the big question worrying voters. What did he say? By Mark Sappenfield, editor. Some 236 years ago, it would seem that James Madison foresaw this moment. Election Day in the United States has arrived, and the great question that lies ahead is one he spent no small amount of time attempting to answer. How does a nation with democratic principles prevent the winners from walking all over the losers? Madison's answer was a masterstroke of real politic. In political factions, he saw the human tendency to be whipped into groups of passion and ill will toward others. And in the clash of faction on faction, he saw checks and counterbalances. Yet as Americans go to the voting booth today, I wonder, is there really no moral element? On one hand, both sides claim ample moral rectitude. But is morality too merely split among warring factions? Today's politics would seem to be an example of fractured morality making factions burn hotter. Is there no practical morality that transcends and encompasses? And looking across the world several decades ago, political scientist Samuel Huntington noticed something he called the two-turnover test. The idea is that democratic governments are only stable when they survive two turnovers of power without collapsing, losing is what tests a nation's stability and strength. The practical reason is obvious. If one side refuses to lose, then democratic government becomes impossible. But there is a moral element to play, too. Transitions of power can only come when there is trust, because without trust, the loser will feel vulnerable. The diversity faction upon faction can provide some protection, as Madison surmised, but this election, a great sense of uncertainty comes from the concern that these checks and balances, as well as those enshrined in the federal government, have been compromised. At some point, does trust need to come from actual trust, not from faction on faction, but from care for one another? This might seem like precisely the dewy-eyed idealism Madison rejected, but it is not without success. Again and again, I look to the example offered by nonviolent movements from India to to South Africa, to the U.S. Historian Taylor Branch called the civil rights leaders America's second founding fathers. Why? Because they pointed to a new mode of power beyond the calculations of faction on faction. They pointed to higher principles that created healthier democratic action. Love was proven to be effective political policy. Madison's wisdom remains. Today, the U.S. faces the challenge he knew presented a threat to the nation, then and now. As American citizens trust one another less, the question of how to protect the rights of the loser have proportionally grown. It has now reached a new pitch. What is the way out? To me, history shows that thought does not move without sacrifice, without transformative commitment to something larger than one's own opinions and desires. We saw that in America's first and second foundings. We see a need for it now. The way of faction asks the sacrifices of time and comfort to fight for what we think is most important, pitted against those who do the same on the opposite side. But there is another sacrifice we can make, yielding our own wants and fears to a larger sense of love. And history also suggests that, in the end, this can alone build the trust that promises a better society for all. Democracy's gems in Botswana. A shift in power after 58 years marks a turn toward valuing ordinary citizens as a source of economic diversity and renewal, for the Monitor's editorial board. A midsummer survey of attitudes about democracy in more than 36 African countries captured a common desire reflected in the outcomes of elections all around the world this year. The evidence suggests that nurturing support for democracy will require strengthening integrity in local government and official accountability, Afrobarometer stated. In Botswana, a surprising ballot upset revealed an important factor shaping those aspirations, a breaking down of what one African think tank called a dependency mindset. The small nation in the Kalahari Desert was one of the poorest in Africa when it was established in 1966, but it became, over time, one of the continent's most stable and prosperous. The reason was diamonds. Unlike most countries endowed with a singular wealth-generating natural resource, Botswana avoided most of the traps of the resource curse. It had dependable tax rules, protections for private priority, and notably little corruption, but also little agility. The rise of lab-grown diamonds, mostly from China, has sent shocks through the industry. Prices are down 6% this year alone, according to international indexes, and are still tumbling. That has compounded conditions in Botswana, where employment has failed to keep pace with a rising new generation. Joblessness has reached 28%, exacerbating income inequality. Trust has fallen too. Just 30% of citizens, that Afrobarometer survey found, were satisfied with democracy in Botswana, down from 70% a decade ago. Last week, voters showed their frustration. They ousted the party that has ruled the Southern African nation for 58 years in favor of a new coalition of opposition parties led by a Harvard-educated human rights lawyer. In his first act after taking power Monday, Duma Boko nominated a young economist with an MBA from the Wharton School and a reputation for fighting corruption to be his vice president. The abundance of a single natural resource can be ruinous. In Nigeria and the Democratic Republic of Congo, oil and cobalt have fueled rampant long-term corruption, poverty, and conflict. Some countries are striving to break such dependency. In Saudi Arabia, for example, reforms empowering women in the workplace reflect a shift in both value and values. A country made rich by a finite commodity is cultivating new wealth in a more inclusive workforce. Mr. Boko has signaled a similar shift. We are an economy that depends on diamonds, so we have to safeguard the goose that lays the golden egg and have some revenue generation while we pursue diversification of the economy, he said Friday. Like the rest of Africa, Botswana is brimming with a new generation of innovators and entrepreneurs eager for opportunity. Mr. Boko acknowledged that his election happened in full view of every citizen of this country with their full participation and endorsement. That humility and respect for his fellow citizens may enable him to see them as the diamonds of a more diverse and equitable economy. The light in Cuba. An acute electricity crisis in the island nation may be stirring accountability and transparency. In Cuba, blackouts may be bringing light. The island's power grid has collapsed at least 4 times in October, plunging the country into darkness. Even under the best conditions, electricity reaches only parts of the population for a few hours at a time. President Miguel Díaz-Canel declared a state of emergency and blamed the crisis on Washington's long-standing economic embargo. But even his most senior aides no longer trust that old excuse to placate frustrated citizens. On Tuesday, the ruling Communist Party fired the vice prime minister in an anti-corruption probe into private business. Several days earlier, Vice President Manuel Marrero Cruz openly contradicted his boss, describing the outages, a complex situation, he called it, primarily to dilapidated energy infrastructure. Such rays of transparency may seem at odds with a government hobbled by corruption and criticized for jailing its opponents. Yet that reputation obscures gradual reforms to meet the rising demands of a new and entrepreneurial generation, such as legalization of privately owned businesses. With the new circumstances, more honesty has found its way into all areas of the economic debate, wrote Marcel Kunzman, a Cuba expert at the University of Buckingham, in a paper published in May. Although most workers still work for the state, he noted, the expectations of ordinary citizens have shifted. If anything can be said about the young generation in Cuba, it is that we are workers, a young woman told him. Honesty has lately helped another country confront its own persistent energy crisis. Since roughly 2007, South Africans have endured rolling brownouts to cope with rising demand on an aging, publicly owned power grid, never designed to meet the needs of a full population. Efforts to overhaul the system were beset by deepening corruption. Last year, President Cyril Ramaphosa was forced to declare the power cuts a national emergency. But the formation of a new coalition government following elections in May that ended 3 decades of one-party rule has already brought change. A new law signed in August maps an end to the state's monopoly on power generation. Democratizing the grid, Mr. Ramaphosa said, will boost competition and a shift toward renewable energy sources. Oil fuels 80% of Cuba's energy production. In March, during a previous round of acute power shortages, only one of the country's 3 refineries was functional. Protests broke out in several cities over freedom, food, and electricity. Nearly 5% of the population has emigrated since 2021. The government's attempt, year after year, to explain the situation and affirm that they are working to resolve it are not well received by a large part of the population. Tired and worn out by the difficulty of sustaining life in Cuba with a minimum of well-being, the news blog La Joven Cuba observed, some officials might be listening. Out of the darkness, their honesty shines new light. Creativity as a small nation's defense. Armenia, surrounded by bigger countries, tries to make itself indispensable by becoming a Silicon Valley in a precarious region, by the Monitor's editorial board. One trend of recent decades has been that of small countries trying to prevent a foreign invasion by making themselves indispensable to big countries around them. Singapore, Taiwan, and the United Arab Emirates, for example, have become global tech hubs or finance centers. A would-be invader might think twice before destroying what it is dependent on. The secret of this strategy? Build up trust in your economy and bring out the creativity of your people. Rely on qualities more than on armaments. Now Armenia, population under 3 million, is racing to go down the path of becoming the next Silicon Valley, especially after seeing Russia invade Ukraine. In fact, the former Soviet state got a big head start in 2022 when thousands of Russian techies fled their country after the invasion and chose Armenia, a democracy, because of its ecosystem of hundreds of dynamic tech startups. About the size of Maryland, Armenia faces a foe different from Russia, with which it has recently had mixed relations. Last year, neighboring Azerbaijan, population 10 million, invaded a disputed region called Nagorno-Karabakh, forcing more than 100,000 ethnic Armenians to flee the enclave. Both countries are currently negotiating a peace deal, but Azerbaijan still has eyes on a vital transit route in Armenia called the Zangezur Corridor. Iran and Turkey, which border Armenia, have strong opinions on that hot territorial dispute. For Armenia, a country that faces complex geopolitical challenges, leveraging science and technology is not only about economic growth, but also national security, resilience, and sustainability, Alan Simonoyan, Speaker of Parliament, said at a conference in October. Last year, Armenia doubled the number of tech workers from the year before. Several American tech giants have opened offices or research centers in the country. In early October, the country hosted the World Congress on Innovation and Technology. Armenia's survival, which now faces existential threats, is of great importance, Valerie Safarian, head of the Belgian-Armenian Chamber of Commerce, told Armen Press, Armenian news agency. It's important to underscore that Armenia has strategic assets, particularly in the sector of semiconductors and electronic chips. But it is the country's fearless drive to innovate that may be its first defense. When creating startups, people think, what if we aren't good enough? Tigran Petrosyan, a co-founder of the Startup Armenia Foundation, told Armen Press last year, I'd advise everyone to make the steps forward and understand the reality while doing so. There's only one way here, keep moving forward, regardless of anything. From Letters to the Editor, Portugal's Draw for Expats. Your article, It's Not Just the Sunshine, Why Portugal Attracts U.S. Expats, in the March 11th weekly, brought back to mind a bit of speculation I engaged in some years back. If family and friends were no consideration, in what country would I choose to live? I sought out those nations closest to the middle in per capita income, combined with the lowest disparity in income between their richest and poorest citizens. The winners at the time? Portugal and Hungary. Today, I'd say the political situation in Hungary gives Portugal the clear edge. Brad Ronsky, Red Wing, Minnesota. Can shrimpers make a living? Thank you for writing about the shrimp industry in From Bubba Gump to Bust, American Shrimpers Face Extinction, from the March 4th weekly. Shrimp from overseas farming has long been on the avoid list because of the industry's damage to the environment, the forced labor, and the use of antibiotics and herbicide. If people were more informed about this, shrimpers like Brian Jordan and Tommy Faulkner would be able to make a living without these negatives. Christine Matthews, Washington. The value of visibility. Thank you for your articles and references to Native people. It gives them value in contrast to their invisibility in society. I particularly appreciate the story Preserving Mohawk at Akwesasne Freedom School in the January 22nd weekly about the Mohawk School in New York and Canada. My husband is Mohawk, and our three children's ancestral land and heritage is in that area. Elizabeth McKibben, Venice, Florida. Thank you for joining us for the Christian Science Monitor Daily, read by Shari Mukundan.
The content featured in this recording may not reflect the views of AfterSight or the presenter. For questions, concerns, or editorial feedback regarding the Christian Science Monitor, please contact them directly at customerservice@csmonitor.com or call 617-450-2300 Monday through Friday.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.